during the time when I was pitching the no-hitter in San Diego, I really didn't know, I didn't see the hitters. All I could tell was if they was on the right side or the left side. As far as seeing the target, the catcher put tape on his fingers so I could see the signals. But as far as seeing the batter himself, I didn't really see who they were. The opposing team and my teammates, they knew I was high, but they didn't know what I was high on.
It's rare enough for a pitcher to throw a no-hitter, but to throw one in the state that the late Pittsburgh Pirate Doc Ellis was in on June 12, 1970, is a feat that's equal parts disturbing and fascinating. Ellis loudly claimed afterwards that he no-hit the San Diego Padres while under the influence of LSD. Again, it's a remarkable tale. Fortunately, Jeffrey Radice depicts that night, as well as Ellis's life and career, in further detail of the documentary called No-No, released earlier this year. In speaking with Radice, I began by asking him his personal reasons for undertaking this project.
Mainly because his biography was so interesting. Donald Paul was a poetry teacher at the University of Michigan, and he got together with Doc and wrote a biography that came out in the mid-1970s, and I just found that the book was very literate, and you could tell that there was a friendship between Doc and Donald. And so that was kind of my access to it, as well as I noticed that musicians started to gravitate towards the story, and so Barbara Manning had a song that was already written about Doc Ellis, and a number of other indie acts had come out with songs about Doc, and so I thought that there seemed to be kind of this cultural cachet, countercultural, with the LSD that kind of drew me into the story and led me to believe that there was a lot of interesting aspects, facets to it, if you will.
Now, this story has kind of some, you know, mythical elements, or like a kind of an urban legend, because aside from a few shots, which actually are in the documentary, there isn't any video of this game. It raises the mythical qualities and makes it kind of an urban legend, I mean, regardless of if it's true or not.
Well, yeah, and Doc was the person who propagated the legend first. So that certainly lends a little bit of, mythicalness to it. Mythos to it in the sense that, you know, he's perpetuating his own legend. But, you know, so that was for me interesting and something that I wanted to delve into deeper and investigate and try to peel back the layers and find out, you know, who could corroborate the story. And you know, so what I found in the manuscript was that he was talking about it with Donald Hall in early 1970s. We found Al Rambo, his friend, who said that he was tripping with him the day before. You know, so there was a lot of background evidence, and all of the people that I spoke with that knew him believed this story. There were a few outliers here and there, but for the most part, people said that Doc was an honest man, and you know, like he would play practical jokes and what he called sell wolf tickets. But you know, this one, if this is a wolf ticket, he's done a superb job.
That's right. Now, I was just about to ask how many of the people that you talked to believed his claims. I guess for you, first of all, I guess how long has this documentary been in the making? And secondly, what were your feelings initially going in, and how much have they changed about that story since then?
I probably first heard Doc's story, I would say, in 1998, but you know, it just kind of passed right over me. I mean, I stashed it away in my memory, but then in 2004, I had produced it. Short documentary that went to Sundance called LSD A Go-Go, and covered LSD-related subject matter, mainly talking about the CIA and their MK Ultra experiments in the 1950s and various offshoots of that story. But people like to share their own LSD-related anecdotes in traveling around with that film, and so it kind of made me think of Doc's story, because it was one of the most fascinating I had ever heard. And so I went and dug in deeper.
And aside from the LSD story, the obvious story of that no-hitter, and something that I kind of didn't realize, because I knew about this LSD story going into watching the film, and I didn't really know all about his civil rights involvement, not just being an outspoken advocate of African-American rights. I mean, 1971 All-Star Game, kind of coaxing Sparky Anderson into starting him against Vita Blue, but also just raising money for sickle cell anemia research, and then conversely getting a letter from Jackie Robinson, which obviously, as we saw in the documentary, was very emotional to him. That kind of, do you feel that kind of over... is underwhelming or has been overshadowed by the LSD story, and was that kind of a goal to highlight that a little bit more?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that his family, you know, his widow and his closest family all wanted his legacy to kind of be burnished and removed from the sideshow, but I also felt like that the man deserved it for all of the things that he did, and that the incidents that you mentioned, but in addition, he was one of the early labor rights leaders in professional baseball. That kind of goes unheralded. Tom Rich, who appears in the movie, his agent, Doc was his first client, and Doc was one of the first ball players to have an agent speak on his behalf or accompany him in negotiating their contracts. And, you know, baseball was really different in the early 1970s in the sense that these guys had to go in every year and do a new contract, and it was based on the previous year, and it was typically the player and the general manager of the team in an office alone. And Doc was like, no, I want to bring in an agent, and he kind of broke that open, and Tom then started representing a lot of the other African-American ballplayers on the team, other teams, the white ballplayers, you know, so, and Doc was, he was working in the prison system in Pittsburgh in this thing called Operation Grubstake. There's a couple of photos in the film that are kind of out of place, but, you know, Doc kind of was working in prison his whole life. It just didn't, it went a little unheralded, and then he came back to it at the end, certainly. And I felt like he had a very giving nature, and I wanted to kind of highlight some of that.
And also from his giving nature, he was also kind of a personality, as you've highlighted, not just in the last few minutes, but also in the documentary. That Pirates team was a very unique team. It was the first to start all black and Hispanic starting lineup. They had, you know, Willie Stargell, Roberto Clemente, who was Doc's first roommate while with the Pirates. How much, you know, all that fun that they had together, I mean, did it seem like, based on the people you talked to, he was kind of the leading personality of the group of personalities?
No, I don't think so. But based on the people I talked to, Doc was one of many leading personalities. They were all kind of, it was a bunch of leading personalities. You know, Steve Blass was apparently one of the leading personalities, and Roberto, in his way, he was much quieter, but, certainly, you know, by the 1971, when they won the World Series, Roberto Clemente was the leader of the team, but he had come up through their system and was there in 1960 on the championship team. And the Pirates, I felt, and discovered in my research, I felt like they were out in front of a lot of other organizations as far as cultivating that kind of talent and having scouts in Latin America, but also in Los Angeles, and they did an excellent job of integrating the team a lot sooner. And what's interesting is that the team that they faced was Philadelphia, who was one of the worst teams about integrating. It was the team that Kirk Flood refused to get traded to because he didn't want to go to the most northern city in the south, as he said. So, you know, I thought that there are a lot of interesting things that happened if you dig in deeper to Doc's story that came true, and that gets back to his legend. I like to think of him as a Paul Bunyan-like character, because there's all these stories where hair curlers and hitting batters, and they, a lot of them check out, and they turn out to be even more interesting than you had imagined on first blush.
Mm-hmm. And in 71, that was obviously the best. You mentioned they won the world championship, beat Baltimore in 7 games. Doc, I think, won 19 games that year, probably his best season. Aside from the LSD use, he also had other drugs and substance abuse. And according to what he said, he couldn't go without it. You know, amphetamines and cocaine, alcohol, he couldn't, it seemed like this was necessary for him. But in your opinion, how much did that affect what he could have been as a pitcher for his entire career?
I don't want to go back and debate what could have been about his career, because I think that Doc would be the first one to say that, maybe the substances made him better, maybe they prolonged his career. He said he wouldn't change a thing, because he wouldn't be who he was at the end if he hadn't have gone through all of the middle years. But, I think by the same token, maybe his life could have been longer. Maybe he wouldn't have ended up certainly in the episodes that he had with his first two wives that ended those marriages. And I think that might be enough. They're both extremely beautiful women, and strong, beautiful women. And Paula and Austin were just very open with me and candid about what happened with Doc. And I think that's where the substance abuse really kind of hurt him, and he knew it. And what was interesting is we did not get the interview with Austin, Ellis's second wife, who is in Arlington, Texas, until very late in the production. And, I had suspected that there had to be some sort of dark night of the soul, but I, didn't have much to go on. And so her candor, and she was generous in a lot of ways. She lent us the whole movies that are interspersed throughout the film to use, and a number of photographs. And, the thing that I think is interesting about Doc is that the people that knew him, including these two wives who had some harrowing experiences, you could just see the genuine love and affection that they had for him, despite his transgressions.
Mm-hmm. Now, he entered drug treatment shortly after his career ended in 1979. I was about to mention the interviews that you got from his former spouses, from his, teammates, also Ron Howard, who I did not know Doc was friendly with his family. And later was in a movie that Ron directed. Which one of the people that you spoke to, and there were a lot of them, Steve Blass, many of them, which one of them, provided the most kind of insight into his career, into maybe his personal life as well? Obviously I would assume his wives, but like someone that surprised you, I guess.
Well, I think that, it's the sum total of all of their interviews that provided the most insight. I can't, if I had to single out one interview that personally I enjoyed watching, it was really difficult to edit, but that I enjoyed watching is Ray Jones, who knew Doc, dated one of his sisters. So they grew up together, probably junior high, maybe they met around that age, and they went to separate high schools, but they were always friendly. And Ray was a football player who was drafted by the New Orleans Saints, I believe, but he had to go to Vietnam. So he went over to Vietnam and stayed in touch with Doc over the years. Like, he was always there in L.A. when Doc came to visit, and knew him, throughout his life to the end, and just, very stream of consciousness way of talking, and, filled in a lot and gave me a lot of nuggets about Doc. But it's also extremely difficult to edit and shoot, because he's very mobile when he's talking, so he's weaving in and out of the camera range, so it kind of made my director of photography have to work a little bit harder to keep him in focus. But I found that Ray Jones was an extremely rewarding interview.
I did notice him going back and forth, almost like a boxer, so to speak. But going personally with Doc, one-on-one, interviewing him, fortunately you got to interview him prior to his death in December.
No, as a matter of fact, I'll let me just correct you there, because that's licensed, that is licensed footage. We did not interview Doc.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
It's actually that footage, if you look at it, it's not as clean. I certainly wouldn't have framed it the way they framed it, but we licensed that from HBO, who had that in their archives as part of this. They shot about 2 hours to do for 2005 a Costas Now episode. Mm-hmm. Bob Costas had a TV show, and so they went and interviewed Doc, I guess, in a classroom when he was working with the youth authority, and then they got him, you know, talking to students, got some B-roll of that. And I discovered that it was in their archives and, you know, had used it. It's kind of funny because at one point in time, I was like, you know, can I use about an hour of this? But, you know, we ended up using far, far, far less. Mm-hmm. And very, very judiciously. And, you know, I think it's a compliment that we were able to squeeze it in and make it seamless with the rest of the material, such that a lot of people don't realize that we didn't shoot it. But, yeah, that's licensed footage. Mm-hmm. And on the Costas Now show that the Doc thing appears, they only used about 5 minutes of this 2 hours that they got. Right before that is Lance Armstrong, you know, proclaiming his innocence yet again. So, kind of an interesting counterbalance in that episode from Bob Costas.
Yeah, from someone who's honest to someone who's dishonest. That's kind of interesting.
Exactly.
Ironic.
Exactly.
No, I mean, honestly, it looked like it was just the way it was sliced in. It looked like it was straight from, you know, that you might have spoken to, or someone with, involved with the film might have spoken to him, but that's interesting. So when did you start on this documentary?
You know, I would say that in 2004, when I got back from Sundance and started traveling around with LSD A Go-Go, that, you know, I picked up Doc's biography and went to the library and, you know, tracked down some original headlines just to, you know, like, all right, let me start piecing the information together. And then, you know, I just did research. I engaged in what I called eBay filmmaking, because I just created these really complex searches for material that I thought might tell such a story. And you know, slowly accumulated material and did more and more research and tried to figure out all the moving pieces, because it's an incredibly complex story. And I felt like, you know, I was being responsible for the summation of a man's life, and how do you do that in 9 minutes? And, you know, I wanted to do right by Doc as much as I could, certainly to, you know, be honest to who he was and what he stood for and the things he did. And, you know, so it just took a long time to process. And then, we went into production. We got a grant from the Austin Film Society in 2009. So 2010, we went into production, and we were working on the film, you know, off and on for the remaining few years, raised a little bit of money on Kickstarter to help keep things going. That allowed us to go fly up to Connecticut and interview Ron Howard. I had bumped into him at, there was an Austin Film Festival function where he was being honored, and I grabbed a copy of the Gung Ho DVD, and I went up and asked him to sign it, and started a conversation about Doc Ellis. And he was kind enough to give me his assistant her phone number, and we just kept on trying many, many times, and finally had a point where he had a moment. So we went to his studio. It's basically in this three-story house, and you know, you call it downtown Connecticut, old town, and interviewed him. And he, you know, it's interesting because they did develop a little bit of a friendship on that one movie. And Doc, there's stories about Doc, like, cooking hamburgers with Ron Howard's mom, and, you know, because his brother was also in the film, and Michael Keaton, it was, half of it was shot in Pittsburgh and kind of set in a Pittsburgh-like environment. And, you know, so Doc, he befriended people wherever he went, which I thought that's what the Ron Howard aspect of the story I really connected with. And Doc befriended owners of Teeth. He was friends with George Steinbrenner. He was, you know, a lifelong friend with the owner of the Texas Rangers, Brad Corbett, who had owned it while Doc was there, and then, you know, moved on, had sold it soon thereafter. I think that was the reason why Doc's career ended in 79 is because Corbett sold the Rangers, and Doc knew there was nobody else that would have him, you know, find a way for him to be on the roster as an owner.
Jeff, best of luck to you and the film. I really, really enjoyed it.
All right, well, thank you. Thanks for taking the time and allowing me to talk a little bit.
Well, here we are, Doc Ellis working on a no-hitter.
It was easier to pitch with the LSD. That's the way I was dealing with the fear of failure.
He got it. They're mounting Doc Ellis on a no-hitter.
It was an ugly no-hitter. I got letters about it, but it was a no-no.